Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off-limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's N-O-O-M.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hey, it's Nerdist Podcast number 384. We are entrenched in Comic-Con 2013. If you happen to hear this before July 20th, then stop by our... And you happen to be at Comic-Con. That'd probably be the other big... That'd probably be the big thing to satisfy in the list. That we're having our Nerdist panel at the Indigo Ballroom at the Hilton Bayfront next to the Convention Center at 3 p.m. on Saturday. We'll talk about Nerdist-y things. And then our podcast later that night with Matt Smith is sadly... Well, not sadly for us. Sadly for you if you don't have a ticket and you're at Comic-Con and you wanted to go. But it is sold out. So thank you if you contributed to that. But we will be doing the panel earlier. So if you weren't able to make the podcast, then come by the panel and it'll probably feel kind of podcasty. I think most of the time we are kind of podcasty. Go to nerdist.com for any of these details about Comic-Con or upcoming shows or stuff or videos or whatever. I would like to thank Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Squarespace is essentially, if you want to build a website or a blog and you want it to be super easy, just plug in stuff in, but still have it feel individual and unique and special. Squarespace will do that for you guys, and they're constantly improving their platform with new features and new designs and even better support. Squarespace has an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it starts at just $8 a month. That includes a free domain if you sign up for a year. And every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the style of your website so that your content's going to look great on every device and you don't have... It used to be the old days, you had to go program how it was going to fit on every device. But thankfully, Squarespace... the glorious nerds at Squarespace have taken care of that for you. You can start a trial right now with no credit card and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code NERDIST7. It changes every time. So it's NERDIST7, you're going to get 10% off. And show your support for the Nerdist Podcast. So I'd like to thank Squarespace for their support. Everything you need to create an exceptional website. This episode is Kumail. It's our friend Kumail Nanjiani. It's to even say, like, oh, it's our buddy. Like, Kumail is in our inner circle of friends. He runs the Wednesday night Meltdown show at our Nerdist showroom space with Jonah and his wife, Emily. Kumail and Emily also do the Indoor Kids, which is on the Nerdist Network, which is our video game podcast. And he's on Franklin and Bash. And he was also on our first stand-up cluster. But the thing you need to know about Kumail is that he is... one of the best comedians working today, and he has a comedy special which is premiering Saturday, July 20th at midnight Eastern Time, 11 Central on Comedy Central. So if you have not seen Kumail yet, you absolutely should see Kumail because he's hilarious and we absolutely adore him. So here is the Nerdist Podcast number 384 with Kumail Nanjiani.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
This is really technically Indoor Kids Studio,
And we're kind of a guest in your studio.
What, but now isn't this the new Nerdist studio?
But we're going to set up a different recording facility down there, too.
Oh, so this is
They'll be both, yeah. Because I want to put little cameras in there.
That just sounds erotic.
Just so people, it's basically like a peep show for hipsters. They basically the shade comes up and they just watch a podcast and jerk off.
Oh yeah, but you've had some jerk offable guests, I would say.
Yeah,
certainly.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, Judd Apatow,
yep. Neil Gaiman's voice.
Oh, yeah. great careers, both of them.
Yeah,
I haven't heard the Neil Gaiman one yet.
It's great. We barely talk in it because he is so articulate and has such wonderful information, and his accent is so lovely.
It's really just a filibuster
that we just that most of the time our mouths were just agape just listening to Neil say amazing things.
He seems like he's like a not a full step forward in evolution, but you know, like maybe half a step above us. Like
he's above us. Yeah, there's no question.
He seems a little more enlightened, a little nicer than most people, smarter.
I would tend to agree with all of those things.
Seems to have great hair.
he has great hair, and I hear he has an amazing like Adam Family style house that I want to see as well.
Oh, really? Yeah. He lives in like Minnesota, right?
He does. Yeah, he lives outside of Minneapolis. How's Indoor Kids going?
Great, super fun. It's been really, really fun.
Did you finish BioShock yet?
Oh yeah.
God damn it!
You haven't?
I'm so close.
Where are you? What's happening?
I am.
Keep it vague, I guess. Spoilerly.
I have just. I'm basically on the. I've gotten through Comstock House.
Okay.
And so I'm very close to the end.
That is very close to the end.
But I haven't. I had a conversation with Ken Levine the other day about it and. And because right now it's, you know, it's the game that got me off Skyrim. It's fucking gorgeous.
Yeah. But you won't play it as long as you played Skyrim.
No. Because it's basically a linear story.
Yeah.
And there's not a ton of side. But I know there's DLC coming because I got
the season
pass.
Skyrim, you live in it. Yeah, there is DLC coming, which will be good. I'm interested to see what the DLC will be.
You don't want to spoil anything. Yeah. But I was. Like, the day that I got the news that Bethesda was like, we're done with Skyrim, I was like, but
I'm not.
But wait.
Well, there's more,
there's
right?
There's got to be more. How can you? I had the character for a year and a half.
It's so good. We were in, Emily and I went to Big Sur, and it was like these rolling, gorgeous mountains and the ocean, and we were like, it looks just like Skyrim instead of, you know, the real thing.
Beautiful.
Just like real nature. We were like, it's like that video game that we play in our house. That's how awesome it is.
I do know that I could go back, though, and play the Dawn...
Dawnguard.
Dawnguard. I could play Dawnguard again as the humans.
Okay. I didn't like playing as the vampires.
I played as the vampires.
Me too.
I didn't really find that that the vampire lord power was all that useful.
And the floating, it didn't quite work exactly as I wanted it to.
Trying to get through doorways with these giant wings.
That's so funny that you're this badass vampire lord, but you're having trouble getting through the doorways because
your
wings.
Giant wings. And I never, even playing as a werewolf with the companions, didn't really provide much.
I was definitely a werewolf, yeah.
But you couldn't pick anything up, or you couldn't.
No, and picking up is most of that game. But the fighting with the werewolf I liked was more satisfying than fighting as the vampire.
Matthew's just sitting quietly and patiently, just because he didn't.
I don't play Skyrim.
It's all right. You don't. If you did, it would absorb a lot of swords.
He doesn't like swords and sorcery.
I thought there was supposed to be a big MMO coming, like a Skyrim MMO or something. I
think they're still coming, like an Elder Scrolls MMO. I think they're working on
I'm
going
to be
right?
mad, and I know you're not going to be able to do this, but I'm going to be mad if I can't port the character over that I built up for a year and a half.
Yeah, you're not going to be able
God
to.
God damn it.
You're not going to
It's like level 54 or something.
Yeah, I know. It's so satisfying to watch those constellations fill in, you know, on your different...
It's
right,
the most
man?
Satisfying. It's the most satisfying thing in life.
And then when you start going into that netherworld with the books, and then you can manipulate your...
I didn't play. Is that the DLC?
Yes,
I didn't play that one.
You can. This is kind of a spoiler, but you can if you complete a certain quest line, then you can manipulate your perks so that you can go in. Like, let's say you don't ever use the smithing perk.
Yeah,
you can just go empty out your smithing perk numbers and then put them somewhere else. And then it becomes like a fucking bank account, like a bank account system.
Yeah, guys, you got to be careful though with the smithing perks. I mean,
a lot of the nerds, I bet, don't like that. I think a lot of people have problems with RPGs that give them that specific power because
right.
they think, like, there should be consequences to your actions, which, you know, I understand, but that comes so late that you've already had the experience of the game, and
right.
now it's time to, you know, fix the mistakes you made.
Yeah, get those smithing perks set aside. We're smithing.
You're going to love it, Matt.
Oh, I can't wait to not play that.
Why don't you like sword and sorcery stuff?
I think it just, from my childhood, I just don't care for it. My sisters were way into it.
That's always my favorite stuff. It's always my favorite stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm good.
No, nope.
I enjoy a, you know, good phaser. Maybe a photon torpedo.
Yeah.
Quantum torpedo if we're going later in.
So you want space military games. Did you ever play StarCraft?
No. That doesn't seem like a space military game to me.
Well, it's
StarCraft
not a military game
like
in the sense of
thing that just absorbs the Korean youth.
StarCraft is well, the South Korean youth.
Yeah.
We don't know what the North Korean youth is
we
doing.
We don't know.
They could be.
We don't
they
know if
be.
They have access
they
to
have
StarCraft.
They have the same haircuts, we know that.
Yeah, we don't know if they have access to StarCraft.
We don't know what's going on there.
No, I always loved the I loved the resource building games and StarCraft was one of those, like, it's resource building and there's aliens. Like, I fucking and yeah. I purposely did not play the follow-up because
StarCraft 2?
Yeah, because I just knew, you know, I knew what would happen is what happened to me with Skyrim.
Oh, you
knew
you'd enjoy it and have a good time.
Yeah,
but it's not just enjoying it; it's just like it's all encompassing. Do you know how many arguments I got in with Chloe because she was like, "You've got to stop playing Skyrim. There are many other games."
Oh yeah,
and I don't have enough time to be playing multiple games at the same time, and I'm like, I know, but I just need to do all of this one.
Yeah.
And there's just too much.
I that's one of the downsides to doing a video game podcast is that you kind of have to keep moving from game to game.
Yeah.
And Skyrim was one of those games that I literally could have been playing till today. And when if I was a kid and I got Skyrim, that and Dark Knight, if I'd seen that movie or played Skyrim if I was like when I was 10 or 12, I think that would have changed me as
but
a
you
human
would have,
being.
You, but as a 10 or 12 year old, you would have finished Skyrim in 2 weeks. You know what I mean? Like, because you would just, it would be every minute of every day that you were not in school. And if it were summer, that's your fucking summer vacation.
But it would be so amazing. What a great summer that would have been.
Yeah, that would have been
the best summer we ever had.
But that was my summers anyway. I just played video games. Everyone would get like darker after summer vacations. I would come out like three shades lighter because I was just sitting in front of the TV all day.
Where did you grow up?
Pakistan, Karachi.
You did grow up in Karachi. When did you move to?
So I played video games because outside the doors was Karachi.
Right.
So, but here, I mean, you know, fucking Hyrule. It's great. The currency is the same. It's still rupees.
Yeah.
So if I squint, it feels like real life.
Nice.
What console did you have?
My first one was the Genesis, and then I had the Super Nintendo, and then the PlayStation. But it was just Genesis and the Super Nintendo in my formative years. That's what I played all the time. And I was pretty much the only one among my friends who played video games that much. But I did play them all the time.
So if this was a Genesis, that was early 90s.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Late 80s, early 90s. Yeah, like probably I got it like 88 or 89.
Please forgive me if this is a stupid American question, but what is the technology curve in Pakistan?
Well, for the Genesis, it wasn't that far behind because of like Japan and stuff, and a lot of stuff is smuggled. It was called Sega Mega Drive over there,
oh, okay.
is what it was called.
Better name.
It is a better name.
Sega Mega Drive.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
I had one friend who had like a Genesis, but with like Mega Drive innards, and I was like, that looks so much better.
Maybe they didn't want to call it Genesis because that is clearly a biblical reference.
Yeah. Yeah. First of all, pretty grandiose for like a video game console. That couldn't really do very much, but to me, it was the world. But we got them pretty early, and all the games were bootlegs you got. And so you'd get a game, and it had probably gone through like at least five or six different owners, so it was all kind of beat up. And the sticker was all like coming off, and then you would go and you'd trade a game for like a dollar. Basically, it was like 50 rupees. So you would go to this bazaar, and it was hot, and you just, you know, you knew which stalls to go to, which had the good games.
I have to pee so bad, I'll be right back.
Yeah, go for it.
Are you serious?
Look how much water he's drank.
Sega Mega, I can't get over it.
Sega Mega Drive. So we would go.
That's ever happened.
Has that never happened?
Maybe. No, maybe that has happened at least once, but it's rare.
I know that feeling sometimes. I was driving back from Beverly Hills, and I had to pee when I got in the car. And then it's like a 45-minute drive, and I literally was like running through stop signs, and I was rehearsing the conversation I would have with the cops. Where I was like, I'm a grown man in my 30s, and I have to pee really bad.
If you would even stop, like you would just, I would imagine if you had to pee bad enough, you would be pursued by cops and just fucking drive through the front of Meltdown, just drive through the storefront and run into the bathroom. I'm sorry, you can arrest me when I get out.
That would be such a great like high-speed chase story. Like, a guy just had to pee really bad. And
really
just,
bad.
It makes you feel like such a kid. Like, I feel like I don't have my life together when I have to pee really bad and I can't.
Do you find when you're doing this, when you're on the road, whether or not I have to, I will pee like 5 minutes before I go on stage because it fucking sucks to be on stage and then have to pee, especially in a lot of clubs where when the show is over, the bathrooms are full because the show's letting out.
Oh, yeah.
And so you can't really go. It's like a good 2 hours from the time you get on stage before you could actually go.
I'd read somewhere that if you have to pee a little bit, that makes you sharper. It like sharpens you and you're like smarter and your decision making is better. So there was a period where I would on purpose not pee.
Where did you read this?
Sets. It's like a real thing. And I would really feel it because I think a little bit of your adrenaline is going a little bit.
Yeah.
So you're a little more like heightened.
Yeah.
Awareness. So if I had to pee, I felt like my sets were a little more, I felt a little more engaged.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
Yeah.
Felt great, guys.
Yeah.
Sure it did. So, you were talking about you get beat up games in Karachi.
And then you go trade them for like $1. Yeah. And they were all like bootleg games. And we would get them early. Like, we got Mortal Kombat 2 before it ever came out. But it had like these bugs in it. Like, if you did one move with Melina, the game would freeze. Baraka was always floating like 2 feet above the ground.
At all times.
Yeah. So you would get these games like before they came out. But they were like buggy games and stuff.
So then when did you move to the States?
I was 18. I moved straight to Iowa for school.
Oh, my God. When did you learn English?
Since I was a kid. Like, I mean, I remember the day I started learning. I was like 5, and they were teaching us like the English word for tiger. And I remember being really angry. Like, I already know how to say this. So why do I need a whole other way to say this? And so and I remember being very upset. But then around grade 5, my parents moved me to like a British system of schooling, which is like O-levels, A-levels is what it's called. So probably Neil Gaiman and I had the same, not a big deal. We had the same education. Not a big deal. So I started speaking, you know, about 5 or 6. And then from the grade 6 on, all my education was in English. And Urdu, which is our language, was like a separate, its own. It was like learning Spanish here or something. It was like almost as a second language. But then I watched all these movies growing up, you know. I mean, I loved like Ghostbusters and all those movies. So I learned a lot of like English from movies.
How many comedians come out of Karachi?
Well, it's funny. The biggest stand-up comedian in Pakistan right now, I went to like high school with him. But he's over there, and he hosted the show there that's like the Pakistani version of The Daily Show.
Uh-huh.
I think it's called The Real Show or something like that. I forget what it's called. But so, yeah, we both. But that's it. Not that many. It's becoming more common now. Like, you know when you go to like small towns and do stand-up?
Yeah.
And you're finding now there's like people are doing stand-up in like these small towns in these little communities. I feel like stand-up sort of coming up. People are more engaged with it.
Well, the internet and connectivity is like...
Yeah, and podcasts.
And podcasts because... before people were connected in that way, there were not a lot of beacons that would let people know, oh, this is a thing you can do.
Oh, yeah.
But now, because just information is disseminated the way that it is, you can be in a small town in the middle of Nebraska, you know, with, you know, if you have 2,000 people in your town, you could hear, you know, listen to a podcast and go, oh, that's something I guess I could just start that thing.
Yeah, well, it's so awesome because I remember I'd never seen stand-up, and I was in college when the first stand-up I saw was Jerry Seinfeld's last HBO special, I'm telling you, for the last time. And I remember being blown away, like, you could just do that and people pay you?
Remember the intro for that? Where Paul Reiser's stealing the old jokes?
Yeah, yeah, Jay Leno stealing them.
Yeah.
Like, you know what, I've been doing that one for a while.
Yeah.
But it's crazy, but it's that's what's so awesome to think, like, when I think of like people I really love, like, you know, you think of Spielberg or Terry Gilliam or Guillermo del Toro. At one point they were just like fans who really liked movies, and then they eventually started like doing that thing, and now people are inspired by them, you know. So I think that's sort of a very inspiring and humbling thought, to think that everybody was a kid and they just liked something before they started doing it.
Yeah, but it's such an interesting trajectory that you've had. Like, you're a kid in Pakistan, and then you come to the States, and now you're a comedian, and you're a very successful comedian. Like, it's just interesting. This is very much in the same way, like you were saying. Oh, I mean, I just being from the South, I'm always fascinated when people actually get out of the South, because it's very, it can be a trap. You get very comfortable.
Oh, sure.
Oh, I mean, you know, I married someone out of high school, had kids, you know, a bunch of my friends that I went to high school with had kids, now on their second marriages, second wave of kids.
Yeah.
And it's just very easy and comfortable.
Wave. Another wave coming in.
Another wave coming in.
But it is interesting because we go down to North Carolina, and this is not for any specific person, but a lot of Emily's friends who never left North Carolina are like really leading kind of lives that are, to me, I don't want to judge it, but it just seems very sad to me, the people who never really got out. You know what I mean?
I mean, it's not sad if that's what they want, but if they wanted more and they didn't, or they didn't go for it.
Yeah, when I drove across the country and I stopped at like Bullhead, Arizona, which is like this very small desert town with like a McDonald's, and then like you're looking and like, where do these people work? I don't see anything.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of your friends, especially like, you know, if you see them on Facebook or whatever, people we went to high school with, and maybe this isn't the same for you, but they all just look like, like grown-ups.
Yeah.
And we fucking live,
I know.
We live like teenagers.
Yeah. I know. I don't
look at us. We're wearing t-shirts.
Yeah.
Well,
I know.
I wore a button-up.
Well, Matt.
But it's true. The way you look is different. Like, I've seen people who, like in Karachi, but also, you know, like Emily's friends, and they look way older than we do. They look like
they have lived a life we have yet to dream about.
They've had kids, and they've lived a life that we...
Yeah.
To me, I still feel like such a little kid, you know? I don't feel like a grown-up at all. But for me, I think part of the reason that I was able to do so much in stand-up was that, you know, when you grew up in Pakistan and you sort of have a certain identity prescribed to you, you know, Muslim, religious, whatever it is, and then once that falls away, there's like a huge hole that you are not used to.
Really?
Yeah. Well, for me, like, growing up there was such a big part of my identity. I'm going to be sort of vague, but like, you know, Islam... it's like everything you do, like the way you eat is prescribed by Islam, taxes are prescribed by Islam, so that's your whole, pretty much your whole life and identity. And that's why I think people really only go into like a handful of professions, because it doesn't matter, your life is Islam, you know, everything else is just details or whatever, like those shirts they used to have.
Yeah, details.
Yeah, but so I think, but once you sort of lose that part of your identity, you really have to find something to fill it with, because that's a big hole, and I really had this identity crisis. It was really, really intense and really, really bad, and it took me a couple of years. And so when I sort of discovered stand-up and started doing it, for me, it was like, all right, so I have to get good at this, and I have to do this a lot. Otherwise, I'm nobody. I'm nothing.
What were you doing in school? What did you go to Iowa to do for? Why did you go to Iowa, and then what did you study?
I bet it's gonna be racist.
No, it wasn't racist.
You didn't go for software engineering?
Okay.
Well, that's not racist.
It's pretty racist.
Computer science.
Okay, well,
which is
there
a
you
more
go.
Well, this is, I did computer science.
But racism is you putting yourself above another race. But to say that, well, there's,
right.
Well, he's super smart, so he probably studied something super smart that most American kids wouldn't study.
Yeah.
It's not really racist. That's
good.
Sort of,
then I will stereotype.
Yeah.
The fuck
I mean,
out of
I guess it's racist in the sense that you're putting his culture in a box.
Yeah.
But
a delightful box full
it's
of
a pretty,
computer programmers
it's a pretty
and doctors.
Box. It's a pretty smart box.
What sucks is that most of my family is doctors.
Yeah, exactly.
It's true. And it's like that Seinfeld one where he's like, how can it be racist when I say I like them?
Yeah.
He's talking about his... So I did computer science and I did philosophy, because computer science was the most viable thing I could do. I knew, like, I was going to be a doctor first, because everyone was a doctor. And I realized that was one of those things, like, where you have to want it so bad, and you have to be so good at it, that only the people who really, really want to do it would be good at it. And I knew that I didn't have that much, like, I didn't have that need to be a doctor.
You're a joke doctor.
I'm a joke doctor. I'm so lucky that I was able to find something to be passionate about, because having that 2 years where not having any direction, but being grown up enough to realize that I needed direction, but having... like, really nothing to pour anything into.
You're so fucking lucky you found... because even at that point, what are you, 20 years old, 22? Mm-hmm. You're lucky that you found out then.
Yeah.
Think about people that don't figure it out. My big fear was always, I'll figure it out when I'm 60, and then it's too late, you know?
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, shit, why didn't I?
Isn't it awesome that we figured it out? And you're like, and it's one of those things where you keep doing it and you keep getting better, and it's never done. You're never like, all
never
right,
done.
I'm the best I will ever be at stand-up. No, you keep getting better and you keep doing it and you keep finding new ways of doing it, and you're always evolving. It's like, that's what's so awesome about it. And then you find other things to do. So, you know, you did hosting stuff, and now you're doing podcasts, and you're doing Talking Dead and all this different stuff. So you find all these other ways to express yourself.
Everything you just described is also hosting stuff.
No,
well, but they're hosting different ways.
It's different ways,
they're,
yeah.
They're different. They're definitely – hosting a live show is different than hosting a tape show, which is different than hosting a podcast, which is different than doing stand-up. And,
yeah.
You know, when you're doing stand-up, you're talking to – a group of people, and when you're hosting, you're really talking to one person, but when you're podcasting, you're talking to the people at the table. Like, I know it sounds dumb, but they really are all, like, a degree off from one another in the way that you do them.
And they all help each other. Like, I think you hosting Talking Dead, which is talking about a very serious zombie show, makes you better at stand-up. Like, so for me, like, discovering acting, like, 2 or 3 years ago, I really, really love it, and I think it makes me a better stand-up. And I think becoming a better stand-up makes me a better actor. I think it's all sort of works so well together. It's
are you okay with, or is it odd at all? Do you find the business is disrespectful culturally to you, or they just have you come in and read for any Middle Eastern guy, and you're like, well, I'm not really, and they go, yeah, so whatever, you know, does ever any sense of that?
Well, when I was first starting to audition, I clearly, this is true, auditioned for a lot of roles that Aziz had gotten too successful for. Seriously, I read like 3 Azizes that, and their name, it said in the name, you know, the cab driver's name is Aziz, or the 7-Eleven clerk's name is Aziz. So in the beginning, it was a lot of that, but I've seen it change, and I think people are starting to see brown people outside of the box, you know? So I've auditioned for a lot of stuff that, you know, in this new pilot, I play a guy named Spencer, and they just changed the last name. It was supposed to be a white guy. So I think people, it's becoming... In the beginning, when you first see, like, the first black person on TV, then you sort of have them play a certain way, or like the first gay person, they're playing a certain way. But now we've gotten to the point where you know there can just be black people on shows, and they're just a person. Same with gay people, and I think we're sort of going to approach that with brown people soon. And I'm starting to see that happening a little bit.
Yeah, because you've been working a ton. You work pretty regularly.
Yeah, I've been trying to. Yeah, I love acting so much. It's like such a exciting new thing to try and get good at that I've been, you know, taking a lot of jobs and doing it a lot and trying to do a lot of different kinds of stuff if I can, if they'll have me, yeah.
But I think the other important thing about what you're doing with comedy is that your comedy isn't, you know, it doesn't paint you in a box. Your comedy is just about being a guy. Your comedy is not like, I mean, I've heard you say on stage, I'm from Pakistan, but it's not like then an hour of jokes about being, you know, about growing up in Karachi. Like, it's, you're the guy. You have your point of view that is influenced by who you are culturally, but it's not... that's not what all of your comedy is about.
I think when I first started stand-up, it was right after 9/11. So there were a lot of, like, people from the Middle East who were doing stand-up then. Like, a lot of people just showed up, and they were all doing the same kinds of, like, playing on stereotypes jokes. Like, a lot of, like... I always thought that all the fucking Middle Eastern comedians should get together and figure out who has the best, like, cab driver joke, and then that person gets to do that joke. Who has the best 7-Eleven joke, and then that person gets to do that joke.
I did see a couple of guys, and I, you know, I imagine this is just a survival mechanism, but seeing a couple of different guys, you know, around that time come up on stage, and then literally the first thing, hey, everyone, I'm not a terrorist, you know, like, they would do that joke, and then it would sort of, which I guess, I don't know, do you...
Well, that put me at ease because I thought, oh, obviously.
Course. Yeah, he's doing stand-up comedy to keep a low profile.
But do you feel like that's necessary to sort of disarm the audience a little bit so they're not defensive? Or?
I think at that time it might have been. My reaction to it was to not talk about my ethnicity at all. I was a little bit like, fuck you, I'm not going to mention it at all.
Mm-hmm.
So the first couple of minutes were always kind of rough. People were like, why isn't he talking about, you know, the huge horn on his head or whatever.
Right.
But I think, to me, a big step for my own development as a stand-up was realizing that I could talk about it, but in a way that was true to me and was personal and wasn't just playing off these stereotypes. You know, it wasn't the, like, I'll go into a lot of auditions and people will be like, okay, just, you know, do the accent a bit more. Ugh. And they, I have a Pakistani accent. They just want the Apu accent, right. You know? So, but realizing that I could talk about that stuff on my own terms was, because that's a big part of who I am that I was ignoring on stage. But being able to bring that in a little bit really, I think, is a truer picture of, you know, who I am as a person, and then being able to talk about that makes you a
Do you find that your stand-up is becoming, has become more personal in the past couple years?
Yeah, definitely. Because I think with stand-up, in the beginning, I sort of had, like, I was playing a different person on stage, because if they don't laugh at you, they're rejecting whatever character you were playing.
Sure.
When you're yourself on stage.
They don't like you.
They don't like you. Yeah. So I think being yourself is the hardest thing in stand-up. At least it was for me. And if you look at people like Louis C.K. or whoever the best is at stand-up at any time, they're sort of being very personal and vulnerable on stage, which I think is the hardest thing to do.
Well, it's hard, but it's also hard to know. I mean, it's not just hard to be yourself on stage. I think it's hard to know yourself because you don't – most people aren't forced to be introspective in that way because they're having to re-express it to a large group of people. You like what you like. You sort of go through your day.
Yeah.
But you're not really normally very aware of what – you know. And I think that's why it's so hard when you first start doing stand-up because, you know, someone might go – oh, well, you know, you grew up liking this thing. Why don't you write about that? And you're like, oh, no, that's my family. It's not interesting to anybody. You know, like, you just don't see it. You don't see yourself as particularly interesting.
Yeah, I think, like, the biggest lesson with writing and everything is that people have, you know, this is like, the more specific you are, the more relatable it is. Even if it's something, like, very, very off. Like, if I could tell a story about being from Karachi and, you know, something very specific. But I think that allows people to sort of latch onto it and relate it to stuff that's happening in their lives more than just sort of doing these, you know, stereotypes or thinking what people want, trying to tell them what they want to hear. I think you try and do talk about what you want to talk about and people will find their way to you, you know?
Yeah. And have you found, I would imagine that doing the podcast, it's because now you guys are, what episode are you on now? You must be well over, what episode are they on, Katie? 90. I mean, that's over. Really, if you average it out, it's over 100 hours of just talking.
Yeah, and I really have. I've been playing video games my whole life, and that's a big part of who I am. You know, and I think doing the podcast has also forced me to think about video games in a critical way and why I like them and what I like about them. And I think it's the same with stand up and everything. You sort of have to figure out a take on everything, and it makes you more introspective because you have to communicate who you are to people.
By the way, you know I adore your wife. Emily is the fucking coolest. I don't know. I mean, she's super smart. It must be kind of was it frightening at all to basically marry a psychologist?
Yeah, well, my dad is a psychiatrist, though. Let's not think about that too much. But
so is Frasier.
Right? It's true. You're just like Frasier.
I'm kind of like Frasier. I think it's not for me, because when I was a little kid, I wanted to be a psychologist. So I definitely like would try and like think about what people were thinking and shit like that. And I think with Emily, being married to a therapist is good in that she can see through my bullshit, but she can also see through her own bullshit. And when we have, like, you know, when we have arguments, I think it's good to sort of know, all right, I know what I'm doing. Because I'll do stuff that's bad and wrong, but I always know sort of why I'm doing it. And when I don't, she's there to tell me in a very good way, not in, like, a therapy way. I mean, in a therapy way, but not, like, in a shitty... She's like, okay, you're upset about this, or you're pouring it into this because you can't do anything about this. And I'm like, that's exactly what I'm doing.
But do you worry sometimes that, because obviously in a relationship, there has to be a romantic relationship. And I would imagine sometimes, particularly being a comedian, there might be a slight tendency to lean a little hard because you know, like, oh, she's smarter about this stuff than I am. And I'm just going to lean on her with all my problems because she's a psychologist. Do you find that at all?
No. I think what I try...
Okay, that's what I would do.
Okay. What I try and do is, like, when she tells me that kind of stuff, and she won't tell me right away. She'll, like, tell me later. And I'm like, of course. is sort of try and keep that in my head and process it and not have to lean on her for that again, you know? Try and understand myself, because and I think that helps you obviously as a stand-up too. You realize the things you do, because she, you know, one thing I always like, I never say yes or no. I always put things off. She has helped me realize that that's just fear, and I need to sort of make these decisions when I need to make decisions. That's always been my biggest problem, is not like committing. And she's made me realize that committing is actually very satisfying.
I mean, the any success that we have here at the Nerd Melt space is largely due to Emily taking over in the beginning and running it, and then pulling together people like Kyle and, you know, like our staff and Zach, who does sound and everything, and really setting it up to succeed. Because she, you know, you and Emily and Jonah ran the Wednesday show here for a while before we came in. And
One thing that she's so good at, because she's a therapist, that makes her good at a lot of things. And one of those is like working with other people and knowing what needs to be done, because there's a lot of different personalities at work. So if somebody here does something that I think is bad in my life, my immediate reaction is to be like, fuck you, I'm going to yell at you, I'm going to make you feel like shit, and if you yell back at me, I'm just going to yell louder. And that's just how I dealt with things a lot. And then she's like, okay, yes, what they did was wrong and bad, but this is how you get what you want and make them think that they're also getting what they want. Because what they want also is to get along. They don't want to fight, but they're upset because this happened and this happened. So learning that, not lashing out, but I still fucking do that. I still will like compose an email that I'm like, this is going to make things worse. Here you go. Send.
Never write emotionally.
Yeah.
When you're in an emotional state, write it and don't send it.
Well, I see, that's the problem I have. I'm always like, I'm going to write it but not send it. And then it's like, bah, send it. Let's see what happens.
I think, you know what we should do is we should contact Google Labs and have them make a program basically an add-on for Gmail that measures how fast you're typing, and if you're typing above a certain level, then it understands that you might be upset, and so it basically, because there was one that would, you could set it to park all of your emails if you emailed between certain hours in the middle of the night, because it knew that you were drunk, or it thought that you might be drunk, it would park those emails so that you could see the next day and go, oh my god, I can't believe I almost sent that out.
Yeah, all you need is like a little bit of perspective to not send those, but but I, you know, that's how I have this weird like righteous anger. When I was a kid, I had like a lot of really bad anger issues, like till I was probably 14, like really, really bad. Like I would like fly off the handle all the time. And now it sort of comes out every now and then. And when it does come out, it can be pretty, you know, not great. So I think her approach is so much better at that. Like if I had to run this theater, it would not be around anymore, because I would have pissed everyone off and they would have pissed me off and it would have been horrible. But she's so good at, like, that's why I think she's such a great producer, because she, it's not about her, it's about the product and making everyone happy.
So when did you shoot your special?
October. It comes out June 22nd.
June 22nd.
Very excited. It's weird. It's my first like album or special or anything, you know, and it's weird. I put so much pressure on myself to get that first hour out, and it has to be perfect, you know, it has to be representative of who I am. And it was, when I was done, it felt so good to be done with it, you know?
Yeah.
Just have it out there.
And was it fun to just be rid of all that material and start over?
Yeah, it can be freeing, but also scary, where then I have like, okay, so I have another date in a month and I have to do an hour and I can't do any of this. So it is freeing. For me, doing that, I was so, I like hit stand-up so hard that I had to take a little bit of a break from it. And that's when I started doing all these acting jobs. Just because I needed to sort of get away from that for a little bit, and now I'm getting excited about stand-up again.
Well, you guys, on the Wednesday night show, you guys just fuck around for the first 15 minutes of the show, so you must be able to snag you know, little things here and there.
Yeah, it really... I think what I love about hosting that show is that you can sort of be yourself and just goof around in the beginning. I think Matt's going to do it with me this week.
Yeah. I love doing that show. It's really a lot of fun.
It's fun.
The crowd's so enthusiastic about just being there.
It's a very non, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way. I think this is a very realistic appraisal of comedy in Los Angeles. It's a very kind of non-LA mentality. Like, LA can be I generally tell people, like, if you have your choice, don't start comedy in Los Angeles because it's a weird a weird place. People have a weird, you know, there's a lot of performers in the audience, and I feel like, you know, in most cases you can perform places and people are watching and be like, oh yeah I could do that, or like, I don't know, it's just like they don't seem to have fun at a show. But at Meltdown, somehow the chemistry of the room attracts the right people, and they come and they have fun, which is what you want.
And it's not judgmental. Like, the opening, you could talk about whatever. And we've talked about some stuff, like, because we asked the audience for stories. We've asked about some stuff that's really been sort of vulnerable and sad, but supportive. So we had this one guy in the audience tell us how we were talking about shitty theme park times, and he went with his friends, who weren't his real friends. His mom made him go with him, and they got there. He was a little kid, and they were like, we'll see you at the end of the day, and we don't want to be fucking seen with you at all day. So it's just like, you know, he was like 10 or 12 or something, and he just hung out at Disneyland alone all day. And so then we had the crowd chant, like, we would go to Disneyland with you, you know? And it just felt so, supportive and wonderful to tell this story that was very, very scary. And then, you know, just it was great, and I love those moments when we have.
What do you
those.
Think about the idea of people who say, "Well, you're not really doing comedy." I mean, like, I don't know who this voice is, and I'm there's no one in particular that I'm thinking of, but I feel like, you know, there could be a critical eye toward, well, are you really doing comedy? Because you're just basically performing for a bunch of your friends. You're just performing for a bunch of like-minded people. And that's not going on the fucking, you know.
Who is that?
I don't know.
I just
feel like
really there is that sentiment, and people have
There is that sentiment that it's not that you're not really doing stand-up if you're just performing for essentially your friends.
Here's
not
the difference. I think the way that a lot of club comedy versus a lot of alt comedy, and I hate using these labels.
You think I have a lot more friends than I do.
It could be exactly.
But in other words, they're like, it's, you know, what I realized about Comedy Death Ray pretty early on is like, oh, this is a theme show.
Yeah,
this is a comedy nerd themed show, because everyone is of a similar ilk. It's not like, you know, just walking into the comedy store on a Friday night and you get this weird, you know, patchwork of a bunch of different people that you have to, like, wrangle together.
No.
I mean, I guess it's the difference between, like, having to break a horse in a rodeo versus just being able to ride a people-friendly horse.
I think there's benefit to that, but I think the different mentality is a lot of club comedians, and again, just very broad strokes, the way they talk about stand-up can be very aggressive. It's almost like you versus the audience.
Right,
I really beat him up.
Right.
I killed. You know, like, I slayed.
I never thought about
that. It's very aggressive. Whereas with a lot of alt comedians, at least the way I try and approach it, it's sort of we're all in it together, and you're having more of a conversation rather than me, like, punching them till they laugh, you know?
Right.
And, you know, the Bill Burr set at Opie and Anthony show, that's a really great show to watch. But you know when they hate him and then he wins them over?
Oh, when he's at that outdoors?
It's an amazing set, and it's very inspiring to watch, but that's definitely like, I'm going to beat you up until you like me kind of thing.
That is a masterclass in not, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
The line that he's able to walk to not get murdered and to basically tell them they're fucking idiots and have them love him for doing it.
Exactly.
And to not take shit from a very drunk of thousands of people, that's a fucking.
It's an amazing set. It's an amazing set, but it's very different from like an alt approach to stand up, which is alt would be, you know, at least here at Meltdown, it's very with. It's like, here, I told you something that's embarrassing about myself. Now you do that,
right?
Or like trying to relate to them rather than, you know, making fun of them until they love you,
right?
And I think that's why a lot of, like, you know, I know I've heard Bill Burr talk about, and I think he's an amazing comedian, talk about how he hates like alt stand up because of exactly that. Like, you're not fighting the audience. These people already love you. Well, you know what? that's fine. That, we're still doing something. We get to do something, I think, that is riskier on stage than if the than if you had to win over the audience each time. You know, like you really get to know someone. Like my wife, I'm gonna know her more after 2 years when she's already loves me, and we get to find out more about each other.
Right,
and it's more of an intimate thing. Same with stand up. If they already like you, you're able to do things that you wouldn't be able to do if you had to win them over every single time.
Yeah, yeah. I don't. I mean, yeah. Bill's one of my favorite comics. I think he's probably one of the top three comics.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Working today, and it is it is incredible to watch someone throw out a premise that the audience does not want to support.
Yeah,
and then he is able to essentially force them to laugh against their will.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah,
is a pretty.
He did this thing about how he hates Steve Jobs. Did you hear that?
Yes.
He did it on Conan.
He did it on Conan, and it fucking destroyed.
Amazing. In the beginning, people are like, "Man, this guy died of cancer. He's like our hero. What are you doing?" And by the end, you're laughing because he's so funny.
Yeah,
he's just really funny.
It's almost like a weird kind of Marquis de Sade thing to it, where it's like, I'm going to torture you with pleasure.
Yeah.
And you're going to be against it at first, but then, you know, then you're going to beg for it. Like,
yeah.
There's this kind of weird, and that's not my, I don't do that. I'm a very, like, hey, let's all, you know, like, yeah. We're all fucking hanging out, you know, we're having fun.
Yeah. I get into that mode sometimes where, like, Emily yells at me where I'll, like, get stuck on one thing and I'll just push an audience to see how far I can push him. Like, while I was preparing for my stand-up set, the night before I did this was in Austin, I did a set at Cap City, which is a great club.
Yeah.
And I was having a really good set. I was just doing a 10-minute short set to, like, just kind of, you know, be loose. And then at one point I said one sentence, and it didn't really get a big laugh. And so I swear, I got into this thing, I just said that sentence over and over, like, 25 to 30 times. Just to see how far I could push these people. And bring them back. But it's not like, again, it's not a thing of, I wasn't actively trying to do that. It's just some part of me was like, I'm going to say this and say this and say this. Kind of because a little bit I was so like, I'd been doing so much stand-up that I wanted to like do something different, you know?
Sure.
But it kind of ruined that set. Like I wasn't really able to get them back. So the last set I had before my special started off great. And then I kind of like alienated everyone. And my agent was there and he was like, What the fuck was that?
Well, you know, but yeah, then you're fucking around. It's not like you're going to do that on the special.
No, not at all.
But I think in a way, I'll tell you what I think was actually smart about it, was that it got you outside of being doing a set by rote.
Yeah.
Where it just kind of kicked you out of that, so you don't go into robot mode.
Yeah.
And then this joke, it just got you thinking about your stuff and loosened up your brain. I think your brain was actually helping you and you didn't realize
it. I think so. And I think because I've been doing that set so much that I was sort of getting into that rote thing. And I think it's the same thing with stand-up as it is with acting or as it is with hosting. It's all about like being in the moment and reacting. That's the hardest thing. But once you're there, it feels so good. And that's why I think they all sort of feed into each other, because it's all... Everything we do is about being in the moment, you know, and reacting. And I mean, I've never taken any acting classes or anything, but that's like the hardest thing for me. Well, that's the thing that I try and do whenever I do that, is just be in the moment and react as if a normal person would.
Have you performed in Pakistan ever?
No. I haven't been back since I moved here.
Oh, you haven't?
Are you allowed back?
I'm allowed back.
Okay.
Yeah. I really want to go back. There's certain things I've said on stage that, if they knew about him, would be real bad for me, because sacrilege is punishable by death.
Yeah.
Like, that's the law. You know how we have separation of church and state here? That is not a concept over there at all. So there's certain things I've said that I've never said anything against Islam, but I've said certain things that if you wanted to, you could really fuck me. You know, so a little bit, I'm a little bit scared of that.
Do you have you ever performed... Have you ever performed in your first language?
No, I never have. I've never performed in Urdu. It's weird.
Could you? Would the rhythms work? Would the words mean the same?
I don't know. I can certainly feel when I'm speaking in Urdu, my brain goes into a different gear. Like, I think there's studies that say that people who have, different grammatical structures sort of make people think about problems and everything differently. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, honestly, if I'm super funny, if I would be funny in Urdu. Because the grammatical structure is like very different, and I don't know. Like, I could, if I'm speaking to my parents in Urdu and then I turn to Emily to start talking, it certainly takes me a second to, like it's a little jarring, the switch.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I would be as fluid doing stand-up in Urdu.
Was the Benjamin Button bit, that was your bit, wasn't
it? Yeah.
Could you do that in Urdu?
I don't know. I know that the stand-up that I was talking about, who's big in Pakistan, is also doing it in English.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Okay.
I haven't heard a lot of, like, stand-up in Urdu. But if I went back, I would perform in English. I don't think I'd try and perform it. Like, I know Eddie Izzard, like, performs in French and stuff. I'm like, that's... like, what are you doing? Do you think you've, like, figured out American, like, English stand-up? By the way, I love Eddie Izzard, but it seems like such a... unnecessary challenge.
I mean, I've thought many times, would I be able to translate this to, like, the only language that I even kind of speak is Italian, and I think, would I be able to translate this into Italian? And then I think, no, because there are so many cultural subtleties that you wouldn't. It's not just a question of, you know, like, turning on Google Translate and then, okay, now the words are in this language. Like, there are nuances, and there are ways that you would communicate, and there are regional ways that you communicate, and it's, I don't think.
And I think what really helped me with that was watching all the movies, like growing up watching movies. You know, you can learn English in a classroom, but it's when you really figure out how people talk and the subtleties, you know, like the way you, like, all right, good night, or good night, like, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Tone and stuff can be really it's very important to what we do.
Well, especially languages that are much older.
I wish you'd watched, like, movies from the 40s just so you started talking.
What's the deal with airline peanuts? Yes, stool.
You know, when I traveled around Italy a handful of years ago, a lot of the Italian that I remembered did start to come back.
Yeah.
But every region you go to, because they just, like, their language evolution, their languages had longer time to evolve.
Oh.
So regionally, I would go one place and I would say something and they would go, oh, no, you don't say that way here. We would say this way.
Huh.
And so the language would sort of change from region to region when you're just communicating with locals there. And I feel like, you know, in America, it's not so much about saying things in a certain way, it's just accents. You know, like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, you know. Well, I mean, they say y'all, but, you know, if you're in the South. But in general, you know, it's all pretty much the same.
And I think it's spreading, I mean, because of internet and stuff. I think, unfortunately, a lot of those, like, differences in the way people think about stuff is sort of becoming more homogenized, you know? I mean, they're watching more Hollywood movies in Italy, and they're watching more TV shows. And I think, like, I saw the difference when I hear about Pakistan, how much more westernized it's gotten, even in the last, you know, 14, 15 years, however long I've been here.
Yeah, we left them that broken helicopter.
What?
We left them that broken helicopter.
What is this?
When we got Osama.
Oh, here you go. Figure this out. It's like an alien craft that's landed and they're trying to reverse engineer.
It's like the Terminator arm
that
they have at Cyberdyne.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So I think that's changing. I remember when I was there and MTV showed up, and that, like, changed a lot of stuff. Just having MTV there and Beavis and Butthead. Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah. It's a very strong cultural force.
Beavis and Butthead, I mean, to go from zero to Beavis and Butthead...
It's a lot.
It is a lot.
Well, going from wherever you guys were to Beavis and Butthead was a lot, too.
Yeah, it really was. It really was.
It's such an amazing show, though. I love that show so much.
Well, all those Mike Judge cartoons, we used to go to the Spike and Mike Sick and Twisted Festivals of Animation, which is really the only place you could see kind of like gross-out adult humor in animation in the 80s and 90s. Like, you would have to go to a fucking film festival that came through, like, once a year.
Yeah.
And then go, oh my god, this is out there. And, you know, there was no other channel other than MTV who would dare to put, you know, when Liquid Television came on, it was basically like, I don't know if this is the right word, but it was almost like the gentrification of that bad neighborhood of dirty animation, you know?
I remember watching Beavis and Butthead in Pakistan and being like, somewhere in the world, people are making this, you know?
Yeah.
This is happening. And it was so outside of anything I'd ever seen. And it was really, really funny, but I couldn't really explain why I was laughing so much. And it is cool, all that sort of... stuff that's sort of on the sidelines of popular culture is now becoming more and more mainstream because of the internet.
Well, that is interesting to think about Beavis and Butthead in another country because, I mean, obviously, I think there are certain things about the show that just kind of transcend culture. It's like, oh, they're farts and there's jerk-off humor and they're making fun of stuff.
Everyone loves farts and jerk-off.
Yeah, yeah. But also, the other thing about American culture is that those two kids were just like the fucking tip. I think in the 80s we called them, I would say they were like Hesher kids, you know, like they fucking liked metal,
yeah,
and they were burners, and they, you know, they were just sort of dipshits, and yeah, everyone had like a cluster of those kids in their school, like one or two of them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there was also a certain familiarity that we had with that, but in other cultures, I mean, I you know, I don't know if there were, yeah, I don't know if they were like African Heshers, like in Kenya. There were Heshers, you know, like they probably were not, those did not exist. So.
Yeah, no, I didn't know kids like that, but I just thought it was funny that there were these dipshits who did think like this. And I loved them because I was like, oh, they're just doing what they want to do, you know? They're having a good time. I like that. They were having a great time.
Chris just single-handedly resurrected dipshit as a term people will be using.
Do people not say dipshit?
Not anymore.
I think it's a great word to describe.
Forever.
Beavis and Butthead are dipshits.
Yeah.
It's totally right. That's the best way to describe those guys.
Let's break that down. What is a dipshit?
I don't know. I think it's just, it's not onomatopoetic. It's just, it sounds, it just sounds like a thing. Like, look at that, you know, lame wad. Like,
and there's a difference between a dipshit and a dick and a douchebag.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
might be hard to explain, but dipshit, I think, a little
bit. I want the etymology of dipshit. Like, where did that come from? Like, who?
Yeah, dipshit.
You're shit, but let's dip it in something, and then.
You're, like, dipped in shit.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it's just the vowel sound. I think it's just the vowel sound.
It feels great, doesn't it?
Yeah, I really think it's just the vowel sound of like dipshit. Like it just
you
feels
fucking dipshit.
I don't think you'd be like, in the early 1900s, the shits that you would get from having diphtheria. You're like I don't think there's any way to track it that way. I think it's just people playing with words and just words that sound dumb.
It sounded great. Yeah. Yeah. Like,
No one's ever said like, "Hey, twat wad," but it's just like the words together just sound like it sounds insulting, and it just sounds like a way to classify someone.
I like it.
Well, twat wad I get, but like dipshit I don't.
You don't get dipshit?
Don't get your twat in a wad. Like that sounds like a Chicago thing to say.
Yeah, it really does.
You're a Chicago comic guy.
Mm-hmm,
right?
That's where I started. Yeah, with like
Kinane
almost everyone.
And...
yeah, TJ and Pete Holmes and Hannibal.
TJ Miller.
Yeah, that guy.
You started with TJ Miller.
That's pretty good, yeah.
I've been working on it.
yeah, all those guys. It's crazy how we all did start out together. We used to do these open mics, and so many of that crew are like doing really, really well now. It's Kinane, Bronger, TJ, Hannibal, Pete. I mean, a ton of people.
I mean, it's and almost like... What's interesting, and someday someone will do a case study on it that no one will give a fuck about, but just the idea that you all essentially probably helped each other in ways that you didn't even realize because as a community, you know, you're elevated by one guy who was elevated by another guy who was elevated by another guy, and you're all kind of watching each other and playing off each other's energies without realizing it, and then it just something magical about, you know, your class, whatever that class – well, we're the class of 2001 or whatever – whatever something magical about that class has yielded so many incredible, successful comics.
I think at that point, there was such, like, when we were all doing stand-up together, there was such, like, an emphasis on originality, even more than being funny. Like, if there was anything that was even slightly hacky, they would make fun of you. So right from the very beginning, it was never about really getting laughs. It was about being like original and being yourself. And, you know, when I first saw TJ, he was like bombing on stage. And I remember being like jealous of this guy and how fucking amazing he was.
Did he kind of love that though?
I think so. But I think TJ also has that thing where he really, really does want the people to laugh. He wants to be good at it. You know, but in his own way. So TJ can do like the weirdest shit on stage, but ultimately, I do think he wants them to like him.
Because he seems to like to do the stuff where he almost fucks with the audience,
yeah,
to a degree.
Yeah, he really
which
does.
Which is a different approach, I think, than there's a different approach between just like wanting to affect the audience by fucking with them versus attacking them versus like trying to get them on your side versus just
yeah.
being yourself.
I think TJ is also so fearless just as a person. Like, he'll do like crazy shit and sometimes it backfires. But I think that sort of X factor of like genuinely being so fearless really, really helps him in his stand-up and everything he does. I mean, he makes really strong choices, I think, and I think that, you know, really helps him.
And I got really... Because Indoor Kids was one of the first podcasts that we started producing.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, it was within 5 months or you guys were doing the show, and I got so excited because you sent me a text, and you're like, I can't believe how many people showed up
in,
like, video game t-shirts and, you know.
It's great. Whenever I do shows outside of New York or L.A., it's a lot of Indoor Kids people come, and you can see all these video game t-shirts, and you can be like, all right, that's my person, that's my person, that's my person. It's so cool. Like, I'm sure it's so true for you guys. You guys get to perform in front of audiences that are so your audiences that you can talk about whatever you want. You know, I still have those people who are like, the people who come from Franklin and Bash are usually a slightly different kind of person than the people who come from Indoor Kids, and you know, so but you guys have so like figured out your audience so well.
But that's what's interesting about comedy now is that it's, I mean, I was noticing this, like, for so long when you start doing different things, your audience is basically just you're piecing together. Like, I would notice.
Oh, yeah.
You know, some people used to come because of Attack of the Show.
Yeah.
And then you'd have a small percentage of people that would come because I was doing Chelsea Lately. And then a small percentage of people that would come because I was doing Corolla's show every once in a while. And so it was like, you're pulling together, but they were all completely different types.
Yeah. And but then some of them, like, so someone who watches. I would get these sort of ladies in their mid to late 40s because of Franklin and Bash, because that's sort of the audience of that show. But then even if like 10% of them really liked my stand-up, that was 10% that I would have never reached,
right?
You know? And they're not all going to think I'm hilarious, but some of them are, hopefully. So for me, there's no... I have now like one thing that people come from. Some people come from Portlandia. Some people come from Franklin and Bash. Some people come from the podcast. Some people come from Conan. So it's like a lot of different little things that people come from, but I really would love to have that one thing, you know, where like, all right, this is the guy from that thing, and if you like this thing, we're gonna like him, you know?
Right.
But I don't have that like one big thing that people come from.
You will, and then when you get it, you might be angry about it, you know? Like, you know, it could be a little bit of a Chappelle thing where it's like everyone knows him from the Chappelle Show, and then they're shouting, you know, like, you know, you'll be on a show. It's sort of the double-edged. You'll be on a show, and oh, then everyone comes because of that show.
Oh, yeah.
But then also, you're just that show to them, and they're not. They're almost weirdly not interested in anything that doesn't involve
Chris,
that show.
Don't
that you talk
about Jonah when he's not here.
Well, there's the thing. Like, Patton Oswalt talks about how he was on Everybody Loves Raymond, which was a huge show.
It was on King of Queens.
King of Queens. Sorry, right. Was it King
Same
of Queens?
They were related. Like, they were as a spinoff.
Oh.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, 10, 12 million people would watch it. But he would do stand-up and sell out. But it was all people who knew him in this one context. And that could be tough.
It didn't go well in a lot of those cases. I mean, it went well enough. But
I know. It is a double-edged sword. Because you obviously want, you know, 20 million people to watch you on TV and like you. But then you realize... I'm realizing that with Twitter. Like, when you have people... When you get past a certain number of followers... It used to be in the beginning, whatever I said, like-minded people... They would agree, or if they didn't agree, they would like have a reasonable discussion with you about it. Now I have a lot of people who are like, you're a fucking idiot, or who'll get like racist to me. Just because when your audience gets a little bit bigger, you get a lot of people who are sort of not...
I'm
sure it's so fucking real for you.
Well, it doesn't... It used to bother me a lot more than it does, and I think, you know, in the last few months, I kind of just... I sort of just let it go. Because otherwise, it's just a survival mechanism. If I really... And then...
The bigger the family gets, the more likely you are to have a dipshit nephew.
But dipshit!
It's fucking true.
But then also, you know, number one, you just don't have the mental energy to really combat it. And you're not going to fix all the holes, you know? And then also, then I start to feel like an asshole for being too precious about myself. Like, oh, am I really taking myself that seriously that some fucking 16-year-old kid can't tell me that I'm a cunt and I can't handle it? Like, well, what the fuck?
Well, that's a big thing. I was like, I got into a fight with some guy like a month ago or something, and then I realized he was 14. And I was like, what am I fucking doing with my life? This is not what... It's just a 14-year-old kid who wants to feel powerful.
Some people, you know, I kind of just got comfortable with, like, yeah, some people are going to like me. Some people are not going to like me.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, the people that don't like me now were the same exact type of people that didn't like me when I was in grade school.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that there's something about my specific personality type. And you know, listen, being a like a snarky white guy who gets really excited about everything is going to be really annoying to some people.
Yeah.
And now they just have the means to tell you.
I know that's what it is. People would always have hated you. Certain amount of people would have always hated me, but now they can get to me and tell me that they hate me.
Like in the 80s, it would have been, we've gotten a lot of fan mail. Some of it's going to be negative. And then you actually would have had to have, like, really torn it open and read each page.
You also would just get the people who hate you the most because they took the time to write it. With Twitter, even if they kind of hate you, they'll just write you.
Well, then also with Twitter, it's just like with emailing emotionally. Yeah, you could just be pissed off about something in a moment, and then I see your face, and I'm like, I'm just going to transfer that anger. And then later on, if you were confronted with it, you'd forget about it normally. But if you were confronted with it, you might go, oh, yeah, I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
You know, you don't even think about it again.
Oh, yeah, you just, like, have a moment and you say something and then you're like, oh. I've certainly had that when someone said something shitty to me and I sort of had a little bit of back and forth and was like, we're fine, right? And they're like, yeah, I'm sorry.
Because we're narcissistic, we think, oh, well, that person must be carrying that around all the time. And you're like, no, they're thinking about themselves.
Yeah.
You're not that important to them.
It's the same thing that Emily was saying sometimes I would do. If I was pissed off about one thing, I wouldn't do anything about it, and then I would put it into something else. That's what a lot of the Twitter people are doing.
Of course.
You know?
Of course. There's basically, you know, in the same idea that energy cannot be created or destroyed, emotional energy is not created or destroyed. It's transferred.
Yeah.
And it gets transferred to a lot of different areas. I think excitement gets transferred to disappointment. I think anger gets fear gets transferred into anger, which spreads.
But then you distribute it to, like, other people.
Yeah, and like, then that spreads into their, like,
oh, yeah.
It doesn't, you know, there might be a, but it goes somewhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't just go into the ether and disappear.
I think the good thing is that you really can take almost any negative emotion and do something positive with it. You know, so if you're like self-conscious or there's anger, you can translate that into making like good work or positive work. Like a lot of like really good art has come from anger or from disappointment or from self-consciousness. And I think that's sort of what, you know, we try and do is like take positive and negative emotions and do something like good and artistic.
I stopped blocking people who were saying shitty things to me. And now I really only block people that say this is very specific and no one asked, but now I only block people who say shitty things about people I care about.
That's what we should call the podcast. This is very specific and no one asked.
No one asks ever. But I only block people who say shitty things about people I care about.
Okay.
Because that I get madder about that.
Yeah.
Because that puts me in a mode of like, I want to protect my friends.
Yeah.
And so I really feel like, okay, the fucking gloves are off. Now I want to.
Yeah.
So I only block those people. But I also feel like, you know, because for a while I was creating this comfort bubble where it's like, oh, the only people that I see mentioned say really nice things about me. And then you
sure.
go, that's kind of dangerous. Like,
oh,
you still need a little bit of, you still need an element of a check and a balance. Like, it's comfortable to just surround yourself by people saying nice things, but at the same time, you know, you shouldn't just... That being said, I have had people who have offered to, like, hey, I'll be... And multiple people have said, like, that I don't know will go, hey, I'll be the person that keeps it real for you. And I'm like, you know, everyone thinks they're that person. And you don't have to do that. I get plenty of that.
Yeah, please don't.
I get plenty... so many people think, oh, people just kiss your ass, but I'm going to be the one who gives it to you real. And you're like, okay, multiply you by that. I don't need that many people.
In fact, if you're, just be nice.
Yeah,
just be
nice.
I got a glimpse of like a huge, like I did Talking Dead.
Yeah.
And that's a huge audience. I had no idea how big that audience is.
It's crazy. It's incredible to me.
But that was, so obviously there was a lot of people who had no idea who I was or were familiar with it. But even with that, the overwhelming majority of it was very, very positive. But some of the negative things were definitely people who were like, hey, talk seriously about the show. Don't make jokes all the time. But that's what I felt like my role on that was. I love the show. And the other guests were talking very seriously about it. And I also was offering my opinions, but in like a funny way. But that sort of pissed people off.
I thought you did a great job. I think no matter what you do, people are going to tell you what they basically order you around.
Yeah.
And I think they're just not really thinking, and they think that you're not going to see it. So they'll just go, do that or don't do that. And you're like, I'm not your marionette. I am who I am. Yeah. I'm only going to be who I'm going to be. And if you don't like it, then don't.
Please don't follow me.
We're all avoidable.
Yeah, we're very, very avoidable. I'm like the most avoidable person in entertainment.
That was like,
hey, I'm here.
Joel McHale used to have a joke about Tyra Banks being afraid of dolphins. He was like, they're so easy to avoid.
Is she really afraid of dolphins?
Yeah. Terrified.
Yeah. That seems like such a... And I don't know Tyra Banks at all. It seems like such a decision she made, like, oh, this is a weird thing to be afraid of.
I only knew that because of his set.
Okay.
But he was like, that's like being afraid of a bike race. It's easy to avoid that. You never have to see one.
Yeah, you never, never have to put yourself in that situation. Yeah. Yeah, it's not gluten where you have to, like, think about it all the time.
And you might get it. Like, all of a sudden you might be at a restaurant and someone might bring you a dolphin.
Ah, dolphin!
God damn it!
Yeah, fuck. Could it be anything else? Yeah.
This was supposed to be dolphin free.
Yeah. Why did it have to be
dolphins?
What
restaurant are you going to?
Flippers.
Oh, of course.
I should have known.
Yeah. Is that a spinoff of Flappers?
Flappers, yeah. It's a comedy club only for dolphins.
They are apparently vicious, and they, like, eat their young and, like, rape and stuff.
Oh, they're pretty brutal. Like, they're all friendly when you see them at SeaWorld, and then occasionally you see that story of, like, someone was attacked, and then they carried that person to the shore, you know?
Yeah.
But in general, they're fucking, like... They kill sharks.
They're animals.
They fucking kill sharks.
How did they kill sharks?
They've rammed them with their bottlenoses. It's like they fucking ram them in the sides with their beaks.
Oh man!
And you know they also have this really high tech sonar, and they just fucking they're like little military vehicles, and they're just solid muscle.
Yeah,
they're just fucking solid muscle. They're pretty, you know.
And they are smart. Like, I was watching this documentary and what they – to get their fish. This is
Darwin. Darwin.
And it's not a species. It's just this one group of dolphins somewhere. I figured it out where they swim in a circle and flap their tails. And so the sand sort of forms a wall. And the fish in the middle try and jump out of the wall of sand. And then they just – the dolphins just sit outside the perimeter of this like circle they've made with their mouths open, and these fish just fly
right
into their mouths.
They don't even have to do anything.
No, they don't.
And the really smart dolphins set up these aquatic timeshares that fish buy at a very low interest
rate. It's just smart.
Subprime.
Yeah.
And then when they get inside for their vacation, then it's actually the dolphins' mouths are the condos.
I actually know a dolphin who's not using his timeshare this month. So
you guys want to go? Yeah. Yeah. They have like great like retirement accounts and stuff. It's just smart.
I think I just used that metaphor because Chloe and I just watched this movie called The Queen of Versailles.
Yeah,
oh, is that good?
Yeah, it's great. I loved it.
It's really interesting and also fucking.
It's still on Netflix.
On Netflix. Yeah, it's sad and weird.
I want to see it because apparently it starts off with them being like super affluent and then you see them lose money.
Yeah, because their whole thing is built around timeshares and basically like subprime loans and when the banking crisis happened, like that just basically ripped the rug out from under their
room.
This guy had that.
That was one of the things I watched over Christmas break when I was sick and just stayed home for 10 days by myself. I just watched everything I could on the housing crisis.
It seems immensely sad.
By the way, I mean, they don't, you know, to say that the rug got ripped out from underneath him, I think that he basically went from being like a very high 100 millionaire or billionaire to like having millions of dollars. I don't think they're hurting for money. It's just that they started trying to, because they had all the money in the world, try to build a replica of Versailles in Orlando for basically a $75
That's
million.
Where all the things go.
$75 million home that never got finished because...
Yeah, it was to be the largest home in the United States.
Oh, this sounds so satisfying.
It is pretty satisfying.
I think what's interesting about it, too, I think is less... I think it's, for me, it's more the relationship between the husband and the wife. Yeah. And like when she goes back to visit like the town she's from.
Is she from Money?
No. And she seems so sweet and so like she genuinely seems like a sweet person who also happens to look like a trophy wife.
Oh, that's amazing. Know? I saw this documentary. Have you seen Kumare? Do you know that one?
No.
It's really, it's this guy who's of Indian descent, but he's like from Jersey. You know?
I thought that's who hosted Meltdown.
He's American.
Kumare.
Kumare Nanjiani.
And Judah Ray.
And he's this guy who grew up with like a lot of like Hindu religion and like Eastern, you know, religion. And shed it was like, this is all bullshit. All these gurus are hucksters. They're scam artists. They're just preying on people. So what all these yogis and stuff. So what he did was, he's, you know, basically atheist and stuff. He decided to grow out his hair, grow out his beard, and make up a religion and sort of pretend like he's from India, speaking like a thick Indian accent, and see if he could actually get people to follow him on this completely made-up yoga.
Oh, sure, he did.
And completely made-up religion. And it's so interesting to see, like, it doesn't matter what the religion is. People just want to feel, like, connected
to something.
And that there is something out there, that there is some way to control their lives, you know? And it was so... It's really, really cool.
It couldn't be any weirder than some religions, like, it, you know,
oh, no.
that some guy just made up at some...
You mean religion. All.
I mean, if you... Yeah, exactly. Like, you think of... We all rip on Scientology because it's, like, crazy. But the only crazy thing about it, really, is that it's not as old as some of the other ones.
I love that. Sarah Silverman used to have a joke that... used to fucking... I fucking love this joke where she was like... Yeah, I don't think I could follow religion where the leader just lived in an apartment at one
right.
point in his
exactly.
life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. He had like cable or whatever.
Yeah, yeah,
you can't
yeah.
follow just... that guy. It's the same thing with Mormonism, you know, it happened in America. That's how recent it is.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel legit, but then you go back thousands of years and you're like, all right, yeah, there was a different time. There were bushes on fire talking to people. That's just what happened.
And then interesting to, I mean, if you really went through and did a really careful study of all the religions that just didn't survive, that sort of like that went extinct.
Yeah.
To see like, oh, what got borrowed from what, and
that
what
is
evolved,
interesting.
And what, you know, like when you see,
yeah.
like when you see, you know, is the parallels between the Christian story and
oh yeah,
and the what is the religion? What is the story? Do you...
The Joseph Campbell stuff?
Well, it's the... I got to look it up now.
Well, I think... I remember taking like a philosophy class in college in the beginning and hearing like stories...
Oh, Mithraism.
What is that?
Mithraism. It was just the...
You sure you're not thinking of Mothraism?
No, I'm not thinking...
Rises up from the sea and then Godzilla fights.
Sometimes he's good,
religion.
Sometimes
yeah.
he's bad.
How
could
a moth
know?
Rise up from the sea?
Oh, that's a good point.
That's how religions happen.
Yeah, it's Mothraism.
Just believe
Mothraism.
That it did. All you need to do is buy into this.
Zoroastrianism.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's sort of a religion that's pretty small. Now that was big, like Iran, Persia and stuff, that was all Zoroastrianism.
But if you look at the origin stories, they're very,
very similar.
They're similar.
Well, because we all sort of basically like the same
Maybe
story.
Maybe Catholicism needs to hire J.J. Abrams to reboot it.
New timeline.
New origin story.
New timeline.
I don't think that's... there'd be too much lens flare in it. But overall, I think it'd be good.
Right.
I think it would help. Listen, guys, Catholicism has gotten mired. You know, there's so much going on. This is clean.
Jesus is a young rogue who all the elders are like, you could really be something if you would follow the rules.
Yeah, I don't want to do what my dad wanted me to do.
We'll split the timeline. And for some reason, at the beginning, Jesus is driving a Corvette.
Yeah, listening to Beastie Boys for no reason. But I think, yeah, I mean, all the stories that we really like are stories. We don't like to see stories of rich guys doing well. We want to see stories of, like, poor guys becoming rich or rich people becoming poor and then figuring out the thing. Like, so all the religions have the same stories that we obviously gravitate towards, you know,
sure.
all these aspirational good stories. And that's what... every religion is the same stories over and over. And I think watching this documentary made me realize like the purpose that religion has for a lot of people. I mean, obviously bad stuff can come from it. You know, people fight and draw lines. But the peace of mind that it can give people can be a very, very powerful and positive
thing.
Well,
the connection to community and also and also it you know, for some people that I think it is that kind of gateway into spirituality.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I personally don't think you need religion for that, but that's just my opinion.
Sure.
Some people do. You know, like, and that, I'm the same way with AA. It's like, well, I quit drinking. I don't really feel like I need that specifically, but I know it's very important to a lot of people. So great.
Of
great,
course.
Perfect.
I remember like being a kid and going to these religious like services and feeling there were like hundreds of people there and feeling such a sense of power. Like we all believe in the same thing, you know?
Sure.
And I think that's a very positive thing.
We
like having
to
a community.
Evolve. Like I think that kind of, I mean, how do we come together as a culture and be civilized if we don't think that there might be something beyond, you know, like when you look at sort of evolution of people,
yeah,
if they don't feel like, oh, if I do this, something bad is going to happen later on, then what really keeps them in check from just fucking murdering everyone?
I mean they all come down to, you know, rules that you need to have a society survive. And I think we're now at the point, like, I got into argument about, you know, when Jason Collins, the basketball player, came out. And I was saying, people, you know, that guy, do you know what I'm talking about? This basketball player last week came out, and he's the first.
How do you not know that?
I don't know.
He's.
I mean, it wouldn't have meant anything to me if I saw it on the Google News page. I just wouldn't have. If it
right.
was a sports
so he's
thing,
the first,
I would have.
He's the first active player in a professional league of
okay.
any sort to come out of the closet.
Of
as
a team
gay.
Sport, yeah.
I don't have sports
so
on my
home. He's the
home.
First active player to announce, yes, I am gay.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah,
but there's
awesome.
This ESPN analyst, his name's
Chris Broussard,
who they asked, what do you think? And he was like, I think it's a sin against God, and he's walking violation of God. So I said, you know, I sort of ripped on Chris Broussard on Twitter, and people were like, those are just his beliefs. But I don't think those beliefs are valid anymore. I think being against gay marriage is an invalid belief now, and I genuinely think that. And I don't. It's like if I say, "Oh, interracial marriage is bad." There was a time where there was a valid belief. It's not valid anymore. I think it's the same with.
Also, Chris Broussard, just tell me what it means in the NBA, not in your fucking religion.
Yeah. What does it mean to
you're
the
on
NBA?
ESPN?
Yeah. Why are you doing that?
Yeah.
And the people are like, "Oh, that's what we asked him. And that's what."
Are the Wizards
going
to re-sign him? Let me know. Otherwise, shut the fuck
probably
up.
Probably not. He's not very good at basketball.
Listen, he's a veteran, though. He's a veteran, good
it
clubhouse
sucks.
Presence.
Can I tell you something that I think is probably, there's even a more disgusting reason behind why he said that?
The Celtics traded him?
No. Listen, I don't know what you're talking about. There's probably a more disgusting reason why that guy said that against the player is because he thought it would get media attention. And because he knew that, you don't think he said that to get attention?
No.
He seemed very angry.
Yeah.
He seemed very angry. I don't know. I just feel like that's not.
I don't think it's. I don't think if you're in a belief system that tells you to condemn other people for something, maybe it's. I don't.
Chris Broussard strikes me as the type of guy who would never own a pink tie.
Yeah, he seems very, very. I think for me, I was thinking about this because a lot of how to have morality without religion. And the only rule you really need is you don't step on other people's valid beliefs and rights. And that's all you really need. So you can do whatever you want.
But within that, denying this guy the right to be openly gay is not a valid belief.
That doesn't mean that because him getting married to another guy is not really doing anything to you.
Right.
That's what makes it. An invalid belief. If I'm telling someone to not do something that doesn't really affect me, then that's not a valid belief. If he, you know, comes and steals your stuff, well, that's wrong because he's infringing on your, you know, rights as a person. And
not just to be some sanctimonious cunt who's like, those people over there,
way
over there, shouldn't be allowed to do that thing.
Of course.
What do you...
And I think that's why, like, that's the bad part of religion is, you know, defining yourself by what you're not, and then what you're not is bad and wrong.
And the
and
bummer
then fighting
thing
it.
Is that, and then I feel bad for friends of mine who are good Christian people.
Oh yeah,
that where shit like that happens, and then they must feel like, God damn it, now everyone's gonna think that's what the whole thing for us is about, and it's not.
Think of someone as a Muslim and all the shit that's going on, and being like, what the fuck are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Stop it. It's a very, very vocal minority of Muslims that are doing the bad stuff, but it's sort of, that's like the only vision of Islam that people have in America, because that's the only time you see about Islam is when something bad happens.
Well, and because people, whether because we're inundated with too much information to process or because we're lazy or whatever, but in general, people only have one image to put in their head for everything. So rather than go, oh, well, this is probably just one small group of people, but if I got to know everyone individually, I would see that the millions and millions of people are not like that. Like, that requires more energy than most people are willing, unfortunately, to
it's
put
also
forth.
Part of, you know, you can be it's part of our the way we look at, like, Christians. You can be a Catholic person who's sort of a fallen Catholic or doesn't really go to church anymore, still kind of believes that exists. Even with Jewish people, you can have a cultural Jewish person who's not a religious Jewish person. There's no conception of a Muslim in America who is a tolerant, not like hardcore Muslim. The only vision we have of Muslim here is someone who's like very, very fucking Muslim, you know? And I think once that changes, once there's a bit of a reformation and we start seeing Muslims as also people who don't have to be as hardcore, I think, you know, that'll sort of, you know, I think that'll be beneficial. But I think part of the problem with that holds Islam back is most of the countries, anything, any criticism of Islam is considered blasphemy and is punishable by death in most Muslim countries. So that you can't have different interpretations of the Quran, because you could take that to say, well, you're saying what you're saying about the Quran is wrong and bad and you're misinterpreting it, so you can be put to death. And so I think these external rules have really held Islam back. A lot of religions are evolving, but it's harder for Islam to evolve because of that.
Well, this took a really fun turn. It really did. We were talking about BioShock and Skyrim in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. I think, well, BioShock, you know, that works in BioShock, too. BioShock is a lot about belief systems.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's why conservatives hate BioShock.
Do they?
Yeah.
Right, of course, yeah. Because of the whole Father Comstock thing.
I mean, it says something that there aren't that many conservatives who are doing, like, great art, you know? All their stuff is like, all the conservative comedians are terrible and the hyper liberal ones are really good and like very successful.
Well, I don't know, you know, I just never think about anyone. I'm so not a politically minded person that I don't really think about people's politics when I see them. There might be people who are closet conservatives that are afraid to, and I'm not saying I'm one of them. I'm just saying there might be people who are like conservative that don't want people to know because they're afraid
that they
might be judged, that are actually good comedians. I don't know.
There might be politically
conservative. There will always be one conservative who's okay in my book. His name is Kelsey Grammer.
Okay. I think socially conservative is, like, politically conservative is fine because, you know, but socially conservative, if you're against, like, gay marriage,
I feel
like that's getting to the point where being against gay marriage is becoming an indefensible position.
I mean, that's different than this is the size of government and their role in humanitarian versus, like, those people shouldn't have these rights. Like, those are, I separate those.
Yeah.
But I like that you tied it around with Frasier at the end.
Yeah, of course.
You know, we should have you do, because you were the Frasier of your family.
Uh-huh.
Katie, someone pull up the lyrics to the Frasier theme. And we'll just
need to pull them up.
He's got them in his head.
Baby, I hear the news of Colin.
Toss salad and scrambled eggs.
Okay, so give Kumail the lyric. I want to give Kumail the lyrics.
They're calling again.
Wait, here we go.
It's about his
Frasier.
What is it about? What is the song about?
The song is a vague reference to his life as a radio psychologist. They didn't want it to be specific.
What is tossed salad and scrambled eggs signify?
It's the mixed up crazy people that are calling.
Oh, scrambled
eggs.
They're
calling again.
They're calling again.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. I got the lyrics for you. And then you can just sing them however you remember the tune.
I'm a really bad singer.
Well, he's less the Frasier. He's more the Daphne. You know, he's the person with the accent.
Yeah, but she doesn't have a theme song.
Okay, I'm terrible at singing.
Sing the theme song.
Would you help me? Hey, baby,
why don't we get the music too?
No, don't get the music. Just let him sing it.
Oh.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Toss salad and scrambled eggs.
Oh my. Mercy.
And maybe I seem a bit confused.
Well, yeah, maybe, but I got you pegged. But I don't know what to do with those tossed salad and scrambled eggs.
Wait.
They're calling again. Good night, Seattle. I love you.
That's a great song.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Delightful.
And it's a fun show.
Burritos with scrambled eggs.
I don't know why we haven't had anybody on this podcast from Frasier.
Enjoy them.
Get any of them.
Looking over here, maybe for David Hyde Pierce. Or
Eddie?
Moose is passed.
Oh. You knew his real name.
Yeah.
I just knew the character's name.
Moose is the name of the dog.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito. feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly crying.
Lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell
have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.